Chapter 3. The Buckley Era. Constitutionally Shielding Vote Buying. The unlimited giving to parties and to candidates really pushes us more toward a plutocracy. They say it's free speech, but someone can speak 20 or 30 million times, and my cleaning lady can't speak at all. Warren Buffett, CNN, April 3, 2015. There was no history, logic, or reason given to support that corporate personhood view. The purpose of the 14th Amendment was to protect human rights, primarily the rights of a race which had just won its freedom. Supreme Court Justices Hugo Black and William O. Douglas, in dissent, Wheeling Steel Corporation, 1949, quoted in Torres Spellacy, 2014. Charles and David Koch were the founding funders of the libertarian Cato Institute and have donated about $30 million to it over recent decades. They got their money's worth in Ilya Shapiro, a researcher there, who made the following statement, which reads like the donor class credo at a Senate committee hearing in 2010. To the extent that money in politics is a problem, the solution isn't to try to reduce the money, but to reduce the scope of political activity the money tries to influence. Shrink the size of government and its intrusions in people's lives, and you'll shrink the amount people will spend trying to get their piece of the pie, or more likely, trying to avert ruinous public policies. There you have it. Public goods are the problem, not private money purchasing the votes of public officials. Elections still determine who leads America, but the American political system has undergone a seminal deterioration in the past generation due to the income bias, with much of the blame centered on a transformed Republican Party. The Democratic Party has retained its post-war sizable core of moderates whose share, 35%, matches the share of moderates, 34%, nationwide. In contrast, both progressives and moderates have been culled from the Republican Party in recent decades. The influence of pay-to-play is largely responsible for that party shrinking by one quarter and morphing into a near uniformly conservative entity. The agenda of the donor class to cosset the wealthiest Americans has de facto become the GOP's agenda. The emergence of a political party unduly influenced by a conservative donor class resembles events in the GOP a century ago, during the Gilded Age. In his 1913 book, The New Freedom, President Woodrow Wilson expressed alarm about the economic power increasingly wielded by the robber barons of his era. He had in mind Cornelius Vanderbilt, John Pierpont Morgan, and especially John D. Rockefeller. The latter controlled 88% of American oil production and was soon, 1916, to be the world's first billionaire. Some wealthy conservatives of today exhibit behavior similar to plutocrats such as Vanderbilt, who lived above the law, routinely buying the votes of Congress and judges. What do I care about the law? Ain't I got the power? Buckley versus Vallejo. Today's reprising of the Gilded Age is rooted in the Warren Burger Supreme Court decision Buckley v. Vallejo, 424 U.S. 1, 1976. The court concluded that limits on independent spending by individuals to benefit politicians were unconstitutional, and also found that limits on candidate electioneering spending were unconstitutional. Limits on donations directly to campaigns remain constitutional. The decision began a process of decriminalizing vote buying that continues today. As used herein, vote buying does not refer to candidates bribing voters. It refers to political donations, contributions, and independent spending in support of politicians or political parties. Buckley and subsequent similar rulings, the Buckley genre, have produced an era where dollars rather than votes are determinant in American democracy. The rulings have induced numerous American politicians to correctly conclude, as Gillens and Page document, that their career prospects are maximized by pandering to affluent contributors. Prior to the Buckley era, party elites, officials, lawmakers, consultants, donors, corporate CEOs, activists, and media figures, selected nominees for both the Democratic and Republican parties. Elite endorsements were more predictive of nominating contest outcomes than money, media attention, celebrity, or polling results. The Buckley era changed that dynamic, elevating donors to outweigh traditional elites in party matters, at least with Republicans. Democratic lawmakers have failed to support policies ending wage stagnation in recent decades, but as previously noted by Larry Bartels, they display primary sympathy for middle-class aspirations. They seem less reliant than Republicans on wealthy donors, enjoying ready access to millions of small donors, and display an income bias infrequently. Recall that the Obama administration re-regulated the financial sector, bailed out the auto industry, enacted Obamacare, created a consumer finance watchdog agency, and raised tax rates on the very highest income earners to 1990s levels. In contrast, on the Republican side, what New York Times journalist Nicholas Confessori terms the conservative donor class has edged aside other elites to join the grassroots as the party's power brokers. This transformation is the result of a perfect storm of events that included the following elements. A clutch of staunchly conservative and politically savvy wealthy donors, covetous of small government. The decision by Tom DeLay in the early 1990s to partner with these conservatives. A sizable core of small government social conservatives among the GOP grassroots. The 2008 election of a black Democratic president favoring big government activism. And, beginning in the 1990s, the culling of moderates from the GOP. Another major contributing factor to the increased donor influence on Republicans was the emergence of a conservative-themed media complex featuring Fox News and talk radio, made possible by President Reagan's repeal of the Fairness Doctrine, discussed further in Chapter 13. The most important factor was the emergence of a clutch of politically active, wealthy conservatives, an eventuality empowered by Buckley. As a consequence, the post-war inclusive and pluralistic American political system morphed into an extractive, exclusive one in the lexicon of Acemoglu and Robinson. 19th-century Darwinians decriminalized political bribery. When the Burger Court concluded that acquiring the allegiance of public officials with cash is a variant of constitutionally protected free speech, it adopted the game-changing notion that individuals are entitled to spend whatever they can afford to buy the votes of public officials. This purchase of political speech furnishes an individual with a metaphorical soundtrack to outshout his or her neighbors. This novel jurisprudence is grounded in a conjuration, a misinterpretation regarding the nature of speech rights provided by the First Amendment. The Burger Justice's error was their conclusion that the right to free speech addresses the amount of speech, as well as the traditional interpretation that it addresses the content of speech. Critics of Buckley contend that everyone is entitled to their own soapbox and street corner, but not to rent a sound truck. This seminal distinction was noted by Justice John Paul Stevens, writing a concurring opinion in Nixon versus Shrink Missouri Government PAC, 2000. The right to use one's own money to hire gladiators or to fund speech by proxy is not entitled to the same protections as the right to say what one pleases. The Buckley conjuration also lacks precedent. Political scientist Robert E. Much, in 2014, quotes Harvard Law professor Lawrence Tribe explaining that Buckley was obviously not grounded on prior constitutional authority. And Harvard Law professor Cass Sunstein terms the entire Buckley genre an adventurous interpretation of the Constitution. The Founding Fathers, the Framers, numerous states, and all prior Supreme Court rulings had criminalized virtually all campaign contributions as political bribery, vote buying. Congress repeatedly agreed, beginning in 1867, notably including the Tillman Act during Theodore Roosevelt's presidency in 1907, banning corporate donations, Taft-Hartley in 1947, banning independent expenditures on behalf of candidates, parties, or political issues, and the 1974 amendments to the Federal Election Campaign Act, 1971, in the wake of the Watergate scandal. The original intent of the Founding Fathers at the Second Continental Congress in 1776 and the Constitutional Drafters in 1787 was a government free of influence peddling and corruption. They were strongly opposed to the buying of lawmakers' votes, as explained by James Madison. "My wish is that the national legislature be as uncorrupt as possible." In Federalist 52, he urged that members of Congress avoid dependence on donors or favor seekers. George Mason explained the framers' stark concern in these terms: "If we don't provide against corruption, our government will soon be at an end." The framers worried so much that they placed 20 or so broadly drawn, specific anti-corruption clauses in the Constitution itself. Importantly, the framers adopted the broadest possible definition of acts that constituted corruption. They were political sophisticates and aware that any campaign contribution was corrupting. They were informed by the prowess of British monarchs using the royal treasury to purchase royalist fidelity among the parliamentarians of their day. Central to the context of contemporary pay-to-play is the framers' unequivocal belief that such royal treasury largesse represented political vote buying, regardless of whether the recipient would have supported the palace otherwise, or whether there was an evident quid pro quo. The framers sweepingly viewed all acts of providing and accepting donations as inherently corrupting. Harvard Law professor Lawrence Lessig in 2011 quotes British historian J.G.A. Pocock's clarification of this important point. "The king's ministers were not attacked for sitting in Parliament, but they were attacked for allegedly filling Parliament with the recipients of government patronage. For what was universally acknowledged was that if the members of the legislature became dependent upon patronage, the legislature would cease to be independent. Corruption, on an 18th-century tongue, meant not only venality, but disturbance of the political conditions necessary to human virtue and freedom." The Founding Fathers and the framers would surely reject Justice Anthony Kennedy's naive assertion in 2009 that the fact that speakers may have influence over or access to elected officials does not mean that these officials are corrupt. They would instead nod in agreement with Jack Abramoff, a lobbyist jailed in 2006 for bribery, who summarized the lesson of his years of buying votes in Congress this way: "When somebody petitioning a public servant for action provides any kind of extra resources, money or a gift or anything, that affects the process." Buckley and Citizens United. Buckley not only rejects the intent and concerns of the Founding Fathers and the framers, but also contradicts the iconic conservative Barry Goldwater, who argued even before the Buckley era that senators and representatives can scarcely avoid weighting every decision against the question, "How will this affect my fundraising? The role of money is way out of line. It's strangling us. The influence of money distorts everything. Government of and by the people, for example, is waning. Our nation is facing a crisis of liberty if we do not control campaign expenditures. Unlimited campaign spending eats at the heart of the democratic process." Ironically, Buckley was promulgated in the wake of the Watergate break-in and corruption scandal that induced enactment of the most comprehensive legislation ever in U.S. history to criminalize political bribery. The 1974 amendments to the Federal Election Campaign Act, FECA, established strict limits on donations and campaign spending, mandated only public funding of presidential elections, and established the Federal Election Commission to police campaign finance. These aggressive FECA expansions were the high watermark in America's struggle to corral vote buying and improve voter equality. The pinnacle of American political equality embodied in the FICA amendments lasted only 2 years. Since 1976, Buckley has been affirmed and expanded by rulings of bare majorities of the subsequent Rehnquist and Roberts Supreme Courts. The Buckley genre has grown to now include First National Bank of Boston versus Bellotti, 1978, Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, 2010, and McCutcheon versus Federal Election Commission, 2013. The genre also includes the SpeechNow.org versus Federal Election Commission ruling in 2010, permitting unlimited donations. Although issued by the District of Columbia Circuit Court of Appeals, it was based on Citizens United and was favorably reviewed by the conservative Republican majority on the Roberts Court, hereinafter Roberts Republicans. Lacking precedent and defying original intent, the original Buckley ruling and the Roberts Court ruling in Citizens United featured legal legerdemain. Citizens United redefined natural persons to include, well, unnatural persons, drawing on the mischief first conjured in Santa Clara, discussed later, by the Morris-Waite Supreme Court in 1886. Inanimate legal artifices, such as corporations, cannot vote, attend church, speak, read, pray, or hold office. Nor are they natural persons, as defined by Chief Justice John Marshall 2 centuries ago. A corporation is an artificial being, invisible, intangible, and existing only in contemplation of law. Former Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke agrees. A financial firm is, of course, a legal fiction. It's not a person. And so does Goldwater, drawing the line quaintly at flesh and blood. Financial contributions to political campaigns should be made by individuals and individuals alone. The root of the Buckley genre is 19th century social Darwinism. The fittest, anointed by the market, should not be hobbled by the unfittest, read on, in the theocratic terms, favored by the likes of William Graham Sumner. A pioneering 19th-century sociologist at Yale, Sumner gave aid and comfort to plutocrats of the day, providing a veneer of scholarship in his 1883 book, What Social Classes Owe to Each Other, for their rampant pay-to-play during the Gilded Age. Let it be understood that we cannot go outside of this alternative. Liberty, inequality, survival of the fittest, not liberty, equality, survival of the unfittest. In their bodies of work bearing on economic and political concerns, the conservative majorities of the Berger, Rehnquist, and Roberts courts have dusted off Sumner's 19th-century notion, ruling repeatedly to crown his fittest. They have mimicked the Melville Fuller Court Justice, David Brewer, who wrote in Pollock v. Farmers Loan and Trust Company, 1895, that civilization's unvarying law is that the wealth of a community will be in the hands of a few. They have explicitly rejected Aristotle, not to mention James Madison, Barry Goldwater, and prominent contemporary scholars such as the late Robert Dahl. They have disenfranchised the powerless and protected the propertied, gilding the donor class, just as historian Lawrence Goldstone suggested that the Waite and Fuller courts bequeathed legitimacy to robber barons of their day. Social Darwinism had given the capitalist class a great gift, the ability to consider itself virtuous while acting in blatant self-interest. In the 1780s, slaveholders brandished their Bibles. In the 1880s, Andrew Carnegie brandished social statistics. And in the 1980s, conservative billionaires brandished Buckley. The courts of the Buckley era have exalted the fittest by creating a novel constitutionally shielded category of speech, a category that can only be purchased. Thus, it is the preserve of those Americans whom the late Justice Scalia believed best represent the most significant segments of the economy. Justice Kennedy drew on Scalia's full quote to explain his own rationale for providing constitutional protections for political vote buying by the fittest. The censorship donation limit we now confront is vast in its reach. The government has muffled the voices that best represent the most significant segments of the economy. Kennedy's Darwinian definition discounts the fact that many Americans consider average families, firefighters, financial sector regulators, military personnel, teachers, nurses, and the like to best represent the most significant segments of the American economy, not plutocrats who buy legislators' votes. As noted by Justice Stevens, the Roberts Republicans decriminalized vote-buying by conflating constitutional protections for speech content with its volume. Abruptly, money in support of politicians became protected speech. Chief Justice Roberts asserted that the court must give the benefit of any doubt to protecting rather than stifling speech. This novelty was reasserted in the court's subsequent ruling, McCutcheon v. Federal Election Commission, 2014. Which further eased limits on political giving. Millionaire Sean McCutcheon, the prevailing party in that suit, unintentionally, if aptly, described the Roberts Republicans' theology this way: "I would think everybody would be for more money in politics like I am, because we're just spreading speech." And that theology was famously synthesized earlier in the Buckley era by the Ford administration Solicitor General Robert Bork. Money can sometimes be the equivalent of speech. Money is a proxy for speech. Given the nearly two-century legal precedent criminalizing vote-buying, and the fear of the corrosive impact of pay-to-play by the founding fathers, the framers, and iconic conservatives such as Goldwater, those whom Kennedy and Scalia viewed as the most significant Americans were doubtless agog at their good fortune with Buckley. Today, in other rich democracies, wealthy elites tend not to dominate government because voters and courts agree with the American founding fathers and framers that vote-buying corrodes democracy. Wealthy citizens in these other nations enjoy stout constitutional minority protections against majoritarian rule. But unlike in America, such minority protections do not include the right to bribe lawmakers and buy favorable government policies. Globally, that makes America an outlier among the wealthy democracies, along with Mexico and Brazil, where half the legislature is under investigation for graft or worse. However, even Brazil and Mexico outlaw corporate political donations. The United States is singular in its system of pay-to-play and its decriminalization of vote-buying by corporations. American CEOs are permitted to lavishly fund political favorites using shareholder and investor money without permission. The only recourse of disgruntled investors is to sell their shares. Santa Clara. Corporations are people too. No, really, trust me. The uniquely American ability of CEOs to tap corporate treasuries to bribe lawmakers is rooted with one Roscoe Conkling, a powerful politician who narrowly lost the 1876 presidential nomination to Rutherford B. Hayes. Conkling was among the top two or three most influential Republicans of the day. In 1882, he represented the rail baron Leland Stanford before the Waite Supreme Court in San Mateo versus Southern Pacific Railroad. Stanford was seeking to roll back local nuisance taxes on his holdings, specifically property taxes imposed by San Mateo County, California. Hoping to be rewarded with a large paycheck from a grateful Stanford, Conkling devised a strategy that included conjuring from thin air an expansive concept of corporate personhood that, in a peculiar twist of American history, brought about Citizens United more than a century later. As a former congressman, Conkling was uniquely positioned to make his case. Back in 1868, he had been an original member of the Congressional Committee that debated and approved the 14th Amendment. That amendment enshrined equal protection and legal rights for black males under the Constitution in the wake of the Civil War. It was a pillar of Reconstruction, providing protections against their harassment by state and local officials. But Conkling had something else entirely in mind, an audacious, contrived addendum to that amendment. Conkling baldly asserted to the Waite Court that he and his committee colleagues had also meant for the amendment to extend protections to the legal artifice of corporations. Bothersome discriminatory local taxes and other regulations on railroads were thus unconstitutional. He knew Chief Justice Morrison Waite and some of his Supreme Court colleagues would be sympathetic because they were former railroad attorneys. Conkling's bogus claim for such intent by the drafters of the 14th Amendment was ludicrous. As constitutional historian Howard J. Graham explained, this part of Conkling's argument was a deliberate, brazen forgery. Contemporaneous evidence was never offered to support Conkling's assertion, because none existed. Indeed, the only proof offered in 1882 by Conkling himself was his own spare, handwritten ruminations. A considerable body of U.S. corporate jurisprudence had evolved by 1882, but none granted these artifices the legal rights enjoyed by persons of flesh and blood. The definitive published record of legislative action in 1868 during deliberations on the 14th Amendment itself was called the Congressional Globe. It contained no reference even to a debate on granting personhood to corporations, much less a congressional or committee vote on such a profound and controversial, not to mention bizarre, extension of the 14th Amendment. In a profession that cherishes debate, minutia, and records, none existed. As University of California, Los Angeles law professor Adam Winkler wrote in 2012, no independent evidence to support his claim has ever been uncovered. Conkling was untroubled by his factual vacuum, because he knew his audience. Historian James McGregor Burns explained events this way. There was little evidence to back up Conkling's claim, but neither did anyone contradict him. Most of his colleagues on the framing committee were dead. Americans might have mused that corporation heads packed the Supreme Court as much as presidents, exerting their overpowering influence on the White House and Congress. An astonishing number of railroads and other industries put their people on the Supreme Court. All of Grant's appointees, including Chief Justice Waite, were railroad attorneys. Presidents filled the Supreme Court with industry strawmen to thank their grandest contributors. And the grandest of all were railroad proprietors. In the early Gilded Age, railroads were the central American industry, consuming vast quantities of steel, men, and capital to connect far-flung America. It was today's IT, auto, internet, and aircraft sectors rolled into one spectacularly wealthy industry, with irresistible political power to match. Malcolm Gladwell has concluded that the second and fourth richest persons in all of human history derived their wealth one way or another from the American railroads of this era, Andrew Carnegie and William H. Vanderbilt. Like most billionaires, they were economic Darwinians, and so were the justices appointed at their behest to the Waite and successor Fuller Supreme Courts. The Waite and Fuller Courts' justices routinely favored powerful economic interests while displaying hostility to human rights, to the emerging middle class, or to labor rights. Appallingly, they even refused to apply the constitutional protections explicitly provided in the 14th Amendment to prevent the mayhem, hanging, and vote suppression by Southern state and local officials that were rampant during the Jim Crow era. The Equal Justice Initiative documented 4,075 lynchings through the 1940s, worse than one every week since the end of Reconstruction, 70 years earlier. As events transpired, the personhood of corporations was not an issue in the San Mateo ruling, but the payoff for Conkling's mendacity was realized in January 1886 when the Waite Court heard another Southern Pacific case, this one involving taxes imposed by Santa Clara County. With no discussion, personhood for corporations entered into American statutes with the Santa Clara ruling. Without debate, Chief Justice Waite peremptorily asserted that he and his colleagues believed corporations to be persons, like African-American men, and thus were also covered by the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. We are all of the opinion that it does, he concluded, credentialed solely by Conkling's spurious contention nearly 4 years earlier. Corporate personhood is without precedent. It is immaculate jurisprudence. The Waite Court's unsolicited and undebated assertion of corporate personhood is not supported by historical documents or prior jurisprudence. Silent congressional records belie Conkling. Indeed, that silence includes the voluminous debates by legislators in the many states as they discussed ratification of the 14th Amendment in 1868. That silence included Conkling himself and every one of his congressional colleagues then or in the years thereafter. Political scientist Howard J. Graham noted in the Yale Law Review in 1938 that what he rather generously labeled Conkling's 1882 misquotations of the record are difficult to reconcile in view of the absence of corroborating statements by other members of the Joint Committee, and since Roscoe Conkling himself appears to have said nothing publicly for 16 years, until San Mateo. Moreover, the chief drafter of the 1868 Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment was committee member John Bingham from Ohio. He frequently discussed and interpreted the amendment in years following, even noting in the Congressional Globe that it made the entire Bill of Rights enforceable against the states on behalf of African American men. Never a hint of corporate personhood from him, either. Indeed, the vacuous foundation of the Conkling-Waite corporate personhood contrivance is responsible for its dismissal by two of the most respected 20th-century Supreme Court justices, William O. Douglas and Hugo Black. They concluded that there was a good reason why Bingham, Conkling, and all the others involved in the 14th Amendment neither wrote nor spoke regarding inclusion of corporations, because it simply was pure chicanery. Writing in Wheeling Steel Corporation versus Glander, 1949, they concluded, "There was no history, logic, or reason given to support that view by the Waite Court. There was no suggestion in its submission for states' ratification that it was designed to put Negroes and corporations into one class and so dilute the police power of the states over corporate affairs." Douglas and Black noted that various Supreme Court justices of the era had even explicitly rejected corporate personhood. Finally, there is the actual language of the 14th Amendment that makes it clear that only human beings are persons. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens. No state shall deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. As Douglas and Black noted regarding Conkling's assertion, persons in the first sentence plainly includes only human beings, for corporations are not born or naturalized. Corporations are not citizens within the meaning of the first clause of the second sentence. It has never been held that they are persons whom a state might not deprive of life. Moreover, Douglas and Black noted the antithetical reasoning it takes to construe that the amendment includes corporations. It requires distortion to read person as meaning one thing, then another within the same clause and from clause to clause. If corporate personhood had been created, as Conkling averred, it is simply the best kept secret in all of American history.